welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Andrew Heaton. Happy Valentine's Day unto you, dear listener. Today, I am going to bring on Bridget Fettes as my guest. She's a comedian. She's a former advisor to Playboy, which is the, I guess, the nude equivalent of being a national security advisor. That's a big deal. And she's a writer, and she was in a sex cult, which is why I want to talk to her. So I'll bring her on, and we're going to do a little bit of dating advice because she's got a storied past, and I think it's interesting. But then we're going to jump into the sex cult stuff because I feel that that is the most appropriate thing I could do on Valentine's Day, is talk to somebody about what it's like to be in a sex cult. And then afterwards, I'll review some dating apps for you that I've recently stumbled onto. So stick around for both. But before we do either of those things, we're going to give a special shout-out to our sponsor this week. We are sponsored by Snuffies off Route 44, where everything tastes better from a horse. If you guys are unfamiliar with this, Snuffies is my favorite diner. It's a diner where the wait staff takes your order and delivers it to you on a horse. That's it. You don't need to bring your horse or any of that nonsense. That said, Tom Snuffhauser, a friend of the show, is on the line, and he's going to tell us about some of the specials that you can look forward to today if you're able to snag a reservation at Snuffies. Tom, thank you for coming on.
Hello, Mr. Heaton. Greetings to your listeners from the beating Valentine's Day equestrian heart of America, Snuffies on Route 44.
So, Tom, thank you for being on. What kind of stuff can people look forward to at their delightful candlelit equestrian dinner tonight?
Well, I'll tell you, Mr. Heaton, I actually wanted to call in and tell your listeners about our Valentine's Day specials. Right now at Snuffies, you can sink your teeth into a heaping plate of Ovaltine flapjacks with our genuine Vermont maple corn syrup. Why not add a side plate of our imported mongoose bacon and some scrambled eggs?
Ooh.
And if you're really brave, you can add a dash or two of our very own butthurt habanero juice. And to top it all off...
What else you got?
Eaton,
yeah?
Look, I'm going to break out of the ad for a moment. I didn't really want to do this on the air, but...
Okay.
I need to ask, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Why?
You've been coming into Snuffies every night.
It's a great diner. I love Snuffies.
I know, but you've been coming in for every night for I think about 2 months now, and you're always coming in alone.
Yeah, okay, that's fine because I feel at home at Snuffies. The waitstaff's very nice to me. I don't see a problem here.
Well, we've had, we've got your reservation. Let's just jump to that.
Okay.
Your reservation for tonight, for Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Going
to spend it at Snuffies.
Like
it's
this.
A great place.
It reads like this, reservation for two, probably one, but hopefully two. Maybe if there's a cute lady at the bar whose standards are slipping, Mr. Heaton,
I was very explicit about what you don't have a bar, really?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, we don't.
I've been ordering cocktails there.
Well, that's another thing. We're kind of a family restaurant, and we don't actually have a bar. I know that you usually come in very sober, and by the way, again, I'm very thankful for your business. Don't take
You're
this
welcome.
The wrong way, Mr. Heaton, but you know, you come in very sober, and by the end of the evening, you've ordered five or six of our family Ovaltinis, and you're staggering out the door by the end of the night.
And I take an Uber.
Right. I hate to be the one to break this to you, but there's no alcohol in those, sir.
They're called Ovaltinis. What else would be in them?
Yep. Well, they're called family Ovaltine, sir, and we just make them with Ovaltine. That's really all it is Ovaltine in a martini glass.
Oh.
So,
okay.
Yeah. I'm worried about you, Mr. Heaton. You're a good sponsor. You stuck with us through, you know, some, let's say, legal troubles and things like that. We sure appreciate it. But, yeah, I worry about you a bit.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I will throw out that my reservation, I thought, was helpfully detailed. in what I was looking for, which is a table for two, but probably just one. I guess that was a little bit more emotional baggage than your waitstaff needed. Sorry. I'll be sure to curtail that next time. And for that matter, I can bring a date anytime I want. I dated that Margaret Thatcher impersonator for a while, and I might hit her up. So, you know, maybe I'll just do that tonight and then apparently not get drunk because I've been getting wasted on the placebo effect, I guess. Tom, I'm going to... Oh, yeah.
Oh, I just wanted to say, sir, there's a lot of places out there where you can get some help. If you're feeling lonely, if you're feeling like maybe you're not getting enough action in the dating world or whatever it is that's going on in your life, I mean, Mr. Heaton, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to go.
Okay.
It's been good talking to you. Come out to Snuffy's tonight, folks. Our Valentine's Day special will be amazing.
Great. Thank you, Tom. And do check out Snuffy's, where the waiters and waitresses deliver your meals to you from horseback, because everything tastes better from a horse. My guest today is Bridget Phetasy. She is a former Playboy advisor, a writer, and a comedian. Bridget, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So,
happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you and to all of the listeners tuning into us. I'm excited to talk to you. We're going to get some dating advice from you because you've written some really cool advice columns in that regard. And then I'm fascinated by the sex cult that you were a part of. I read that article and look forward to asking you about that. But we'll cue it off with some general dating advice. You wrote a piece on how to date the 1%. I would either like to date someone in the 1% or become a part of the 1%, or ideally have someone in the 1% sponsor my dates. Knowing this, what general advice do you have for anybody that might be out there dating well into the stratosphere of wealth?
I think that piece is really more about what I learned about myself dating the 1% and how I felt like it was a bit of a zoo. Like I called it the zoo of the 1%. Mm-hmm. It felt like no matter where in the world we went, everything was kind of shiny and nice. And mm-hmm. as somebody who's a waitress and was backpacking around the world, it was a very different sanitized experience. So if you like things a little bit more gritty, you kind of turn in your backpack for a suitcase with wheels. And
I could see that potentially getting bored.
It was boring.
I'd like to get to the point where I could retire. My goal is to become financially independent in the sense that I could walk away from stuff. I don't think I'd ever want to not be doing stuff. I suspect that I'll always have that impulse.
Yeah.
And I got the impression from that piece that there was a heavy degree of kind of boredom and existential paralysis that came out of that.
Well, it truly was. I remember standing, it sounds so ridiculous when I say it out loud. And so forgive me for even being this absurd. But we were in Saint-Tropez. And had rented a villa.
Wait, where you were in Saint-Tropez? Where is this?
Saint-Tropez in France. It's in the Mediterranean.
Course. Yes, my favorite French island.
And it was gorgeous. And he had rented a villa. I say we. He had rented a villa. And I was standing there overlooking the Mediterranean and all the yachts. And it was gorgeous. And I never felt so empty and alone and... I remember telling myself in that moment, remember this moment, Bridget, you are at the top of the material pyramid of, you know, humanity, essentially, because in the summer there, it's very much the 0.01%. And I was miserable. I just wasn't happy. And it was a good lesson. And, you know, money definitely makes life easier, but at a certain point, it doesn't matter. It's not going to assuage that feeling of emptiness that I think everybody wrestles with to a certain degree, and some more than others.
I think you're right. And if someone's listening at home and they're, say, a model between ages 24 and 40, probably what they're looking for is not someone in the 1%, but rather a kind of funny, skinny baritone who wears waistcoats that could make them have a really interesting life. Without necessarily ascending to that Davos level of unimaginable wealth.
It was fun, though, I have to say.
How did that happen?
I was traveling for 2 years. I just put a backpack on. I saved a little bit of money, bought a one-way ticket, and just let life essentially take me where it would. And we met at a party, and I ended up, we had mutual friends from LA. It was just a really weird set of coincidences. And the friend happened to be going to New Zealand at the time, mm-hmm. where he was. And then I ended up staying for a weekend, and he was going to Europe and asked if I wanted to accompany him essentially. And we started kind of dating when I was in New Zealand, and then it just made sense. But I did feel like I had to, you know, a lot of women are like, you're an idiot. You should have married him and taken half, or you should have, you would be set for life.
I don't like that.
I know. It's
I think you played your cards right. You tried it out. You saw if you liked the guy or not. I assume that it sounds like you probably broke up with him, and then you moved on. You did the right thing.
I mean, I'm a hopeless romantic, and I think I'm very bad at lying to myself. I get really bad anxiety when I do. So mm-hmm. I loved him and we had a great rapport, but I was not in love, and it didn't feel as much as I had a very wise friend in Egypt, and he said, get out before you get too accustomed to the lifestyle, because the lifestyle is so seductive.
I have heard from my friends that are very wealthy, and every once in a while I'll fall, like I was part of a poker ring of hedge fund billionaires briefly when I was in New York. In case you're curious, Bridget, I am not a hedge fund billionaire. It was kind of weird happenstance that I got in there. But I've been told that flying in a private jet is a game changer, and it's difficult to go from that to merely flying first class, and very much a plummet from private jet to economy class with me and the other plebes.
It's very... It is interesting just experiencing those things and how they do ruin you to a certain extent. I definitely had enough first class with him and even private jets that it feels when I'm now in, there are moments when I'm sitting in a middle seat in economy where I ask myself, you know, did I make it? I've made a huge mistake. But I feel like the struggle is so, it was something I really had to look at, was how much I had internalized the kind of, I'm a struggling artist but the struggle really gave me purpose. And once I was 33 at the time and essentially retired, but not on my own right. And I felt like you want to talk about imposter syndrome. I have it now, even with everything that I've worked for. And in that situation where I had worked for none of it, you know, one of the things we got into an argument was he got me a Louis Vuitton bag, which I could not happily use because I felt like such a fraud. And it was something I never valued and really ever wanted.
Yeah, there could be
It ended up getting stolen. We got burgled when we were in Saint-Tropez and it got stolen. And he was like, is this you?
You know what? I will say, and I'm not putting you in this category, Bridget, but I moved here from New York a few months ago, and I was up in the stand-up scene in New York, and there were a lot of guys that really were angry at the concept of gold diggers. And I thought about that, and I was like, I don't. So what you're basically saying is, wait a minute, she doesn't really like him. She just likes him for the money. I like her because she has implants. My reasons for liking this woman are very germane. I like her on a very shallow physical level. That makes me honest and better than the person that likes that guy for money. So I look at that. I'm like, I feel like if you're just gonna be like, wow, she's hot, I would love to sleep with that woman. I don't feel like that's tremendously morally superior to, ooh, he could, like, you know, provide for my children in the event that we got married. I think that there's sort of a tit for tat thing going on.
Of course, and you attract what you value. So if you're attracting a lot of gold diggers, it's because you're generally a shallow person who values you have the same values. They're maybe more material or maybe more superficial. Again, nothing against that, but when men are getting outraged that, you know, they're finding these women are gold diggers, well, maybe take a look at your projection.
These are all of my stand-up friends are you know, they're waking up on a beanbag wearing a hoodie. They're not attracting gold diggers. They're just angry that hot women are dating rich guys. And so they're directing their ire at them. But the hedge fund billionaires that I was talking to, none of them ever brought that up. That was not a part of our life.
It's a stand-up crew. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. All of those super wealthy stand-up comedians. Because it's such a rocket.
Jealousy.
Because when you were talking about gold diggers, this is really good news for me because I don't tend to attract a lot of gold diggers. That is not that would indicate I am not a shallow rich person. Good.
Every single comic that makes it ends up dating a model. So it's always funny when they go from the open mics where they're raging against gold diggers and then they're like, and I'm with a model.
Nice. So I'm right on the cusp of that right now because I'm not making the gold digger jokes. I'm setting myself up very nicely to date a Victoria's Secret model. That should happen in short order.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because again,
it will happen.
My waistcoat game is pretty kicking, and I assume that's what women are looking for.
What we all want.
I read another article you wrote on dating. It was advice / what you learned from sober dating. You are sober, but you'd been through rehab. So walk me through that.
Well, rehab was a long time ago, so the story would take me 2 hours to tell you. It was a long journey from rehab to getting sober. As I always joke, there have been multiple rock bottoms in my life. Mm-hmm. But rehab was when I was 19. And then through most of my 20s, I was drinking and whatever. And then I got sober this time at 35. So I'm 40.
Okay.
Currently. So it was interesting getting sober really young. And I was in a community where it was in Minnesota, so there was a lot of young sober people there, and there's a lot of rehabs. But and then getting sober at 35 was really interesting, and dating sober is definitely challenging.
Yeah, I'm 35, and I would I read your article. You make four categories in your article of the types of drinkers. There are, I think you said, teetotalers, normies, addicts, and I think like addicts who are working on it or something like that. I can't remember what there was sort of the like hot mess and the like got it under control. And I was reading that and I was like, I'm probably in the got it under control category. I wish I was in that normie category, but I do have to exert some effort to rein in my impulses. I'm aware of that, becoming aware of it. And I will say, I take a month off every year where I don't drink anything. And it does alter the nature of dating, I find, or not the nature of it, but it just like some of the crutches that you have, some of the edges that you're able to brush off, like it does kind of change a little bit in the same way that karaoke can be a little bit different, doing it dead dry sober, as opposed to having, you know, a drink before you go up.
It definitely, for me, the experience of it was a lot more awkward. I guess I didn't remember dating when it's really good, you know it's good, but when it's awkward, oh boy, you feel it.
See, I think it's always awkward for me. I think it's just a question of what kind of awkward. Is it fun awkward? Is it innervating awkward, or is it just heinous awkward? But it's all on the awkwardness scale.
You don't have dates where you just flow? Where it's just kind of easy and you start.
No, that's, you know what, that's true. That's me going into comedian mode. True. You do get into those grooves where everything feels comfortable. I'll say occasionally you'll meet somebody where it's as if you've known them for a while. There's a sense of immediate comfort, and then the awkwardness is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might.
I feel like when those dates are much more noticeable against the backdrop of usually awkwardness.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Because I would drink through a lot of that awkwardness.
Yeah, I think that's a fairly common tactic. But I assume overall it's been beneficial to move into that territory.
I love it. I think that everything's better, and again, it just gets you in touch with your baseline. So I actually know how I'm feeling about somebody or a situation, as opposed to second guessing myself.
Yeah.
Before I feel like I never really knew if it was, especially if I was smoking weed, did I just feel, you know, that soft buzz of marijuana that made everything a little bit fuzzy? Or do I actually have warm fuzzies for this person? Is this person being a jerk, or am I just drunk and being belligerent? Or
I could see how that would be very beneficial to be able to sidestep those mental traps and deal with the situation in the raw.
And the sex is much better.
Oh, okay. Well, when I resume having sex here with I assume the forthcoming Victoria's Secret model, I will be sure to try that out. So I'm going to jump the questions a little bit on dating and go to the sex cult, because that's what I was initially struck with. And I'll preface this because you weren't a part of, you were in Australia, right? You were not a part of the Wild Wild West.
No. Cult that was way of before. Netflix. I mean, I'm old, but I'm not that old.
Yeah, because that was like in the 80s or so, far, far before you would have been involved in anything like that. Although, did you watch that series?
I did. I mean, I would have been a child on that cult if that was the case.
I watched the series. That's kind of what initially hooked me into this, wanting to talk to you, knowing that you weren't there. You were not at that particular location, but I thought it was an incredible documentary and really enjoyed watching it.
So well done.
And also, I don't know what your experience was watching it, but I found that my let me preface this. If you're listening at home and you've not seen Wild Wild West on Netflix, I will try not to spoil it for you. But it's a fantastic documentary. I don't know how I didn't know about this, but in the 80s, there was an ashram or a cult, depending on kind of your vantage point of it, that basically created a town in Oregon. And then when the neighboring town tried to get rid of them, just absorbed that town. And Oregon was kind of coming off after them. And they basically bust in homeless people from all over America so that they could register to vote, so that they could get them elected in Oregon. It was very impressive. There was this kind of back and forth. And my experience at first when I was watching it, I was like, hey, Oregonians, let the freak flag fly. Let these people do whatever they want to do. But then they get into some other stuff, like, you know, trying to kill somebody. And, there's some drugging people. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, if it was just like, they're into polyamory, I'm like, oh, well, you can
poisoning the town.
Yeah, but when they're trying to, like, they're thinking about poisoning large groups of people, I'm like, I do draw the line there. You can't, your denomination can't be into poisoning. But it was fascinating stuff. Yeah, go ahead.
Didn't they start arming themselves? They became like a well-regulated militia.
Yeah. It's kind of a weird visual sight too, because they're all wearing like pink. Like they're always wearing pink. So it looks kind of like a concert, except with AK-47s. Visually stunning. I highly recommend you guys check out the documentary. So you weren't there, but you were in a cult in Australia. And was it related? Because it's Osho is kind of the central religious figure in the series Wild Wild West. And I think you were in sort of an Osho descended ashram, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Exactly. So it was that.
So you were in sort of a successor state to the one in Oregon.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was inspired by, yes.
And was there a...
And we had to listen to the Osho tapes and, you know, that we would have a lot of the same exercises, the dynamic meditation and the freewheeling love and the encouraging everybody to swap partners and moving people around and almost intentionally causing distress and pushing the boundaries of jealousy and love, and it was very strange.
It sounds like an interesting experience. And just to clarify, so Osho, for because I'm not sure if I clarify this, Osho is the name of the leader of this religious sect, or was the name of the leader of this religious sect. I think he died in
Bhagwan,
late 80s or in the 90s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Bhagwan, yep. Rajneesh, I think, and then he later mm-hmm. renamed himself Osho. So he was the kind of theological core of the group you were with. Was the guru one of his guys, or was the guru just inspired by him?
The guru had spent time on his ashram in India.
Okay.
Although he was Italian. And then he went to Australia, and I guess he was independently wealthy is what I've come to find out, and got some land in Australia and started his own offshoot of an Osho ashram with the philosophy and theology of Osho, and he was the guru.
Okay. Okay. So, all right. So he's got, and how do you wind up there? Are you in America and you're like, you know what I want to do? I want to take a spring break and join a sex cult.
It was totally accidental. It's the way my life tends to unfold, where I feel I fall a little bit bum backwards into situations. And I was traveling.
See, you fall bum backwards. I feel like I Charlie Chaplin walk into eccentricity, but not nearly so colorful eccentricity. You've been in a sex cult. I've been to improv camp. Those are the poles of our lives here. But okay, so you're...
Honestly, though, the sex camp was exactly like improv camp. I remember when they were doing this one exercise where it was everybody having to crawl around and pretend that they were a different animal, whatever animal.
Yeah, we did that. Have I been in a sex cult? Oh my God. I really whiffed an opportunity to have some interesting sexual exploits. If that's what I was sleeping in a cabin by myself, I should have been in the other cabin with all the freewheelers. Oh man. Okay. Well, there I go again, Disneyfying something. How did you wind up over there?
It's funny. I went on Michael Knowles' show to talk about this, and he and I were both joking that LA is essentially a sex cult.
You know what? Now that I think about it, I've dated a woman that was in San Francisco, and she was involved in some stuff. I don't want to get her in trouble or anything like that. But there actually were some like interesting kind of like quasi religious sex circuits that she'd been involved in. So okay, yeah, all right.
Yeah, the orgasmic meditation stuff up there is nuts.
Interesting.
That's a whole nother topic.
I meditate in the morning, but I never achieve orgasm while meditating. I 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah,
I just kind of get calm.
That's the whole thing. So yeah. I ended up there because I was with, I met a guy. I feel like every story I've told you is like, I met a guy.
Yeah.
I was in Australia for New Year's, and then he was going up to Byron Bay. We were in Sydney, and he wanted somebody to drive with him, basically, just company. And he was going to meet up with his mates for a boys' week. And he said, you know, you'll have no problem finding somewhere to stay. It's going to be no big deal. Just go up there and you'll find somewhere. And
Hold on. You met a guy and his advice is like, you'll find a place, don't worry, in terms of lodging?
Right, because we weren't going up necessarily together. We were just, I was driving with him up to Byron Bay because I was just on an adventure and he was meeting his buddies. And then we were going to maybe meet up and drive around after he and his buddies had their week or two or whatever it was. And it was just really a free ride up to Byron Bay for me. And so we went up and it was the Christmas week and Boxing Day and everything was booked. It was Christmas vacation and every single room, there was no lodging whatsoever. And I went on, I think it was either Couchsurfer or what was the other one called? It's basically when I'm totally blanking on the name right now.
There's couch surfing. There's like one for organic farming that like,
exactly.
I never did that. That's some other friends. I've had friends that have worked on like Irish potato farms and things. And
yeah. Yeah. It's actually really cool if you're trying to travel on a budget.
Yeah. There's ways to do it. You can get around the world pretty cheap if you're okay taking a wide swath of time and putting a little bit of elbow grease.
Yeah, and risking your life. And so I ended up, I reached out to them. They happened to be in town that day getting some food or whatnot or something. And so I just, out of desperation, really, said, okay, I'll go stay there. It sounded nice. They didn't present it as an Osho ashram in any of the literature, and they don't necessarily advertise, you know, any of the exercises. It really just sounded
it was improv camp. Come out to Australia. We got an improv camp. We're just going to do exercises. It's going to be a lot of fun. Also, there are koalas.
Yes. And it was I'm a yogi, so I'm pretty indoctrinated in the world of woo and living in LA and doing and being a yoga instructor for almost a decade at that point. And that it just seemed to me like a yoga retreat.
Okay,
and how wrong I was.
Okay. So you show up and you're like, All right, so it's a yoga retreat. Okay, there's a guru. When do things off the railroad tracks?
They didn't go off the railroad tracks ever per se. I don't know if it's because I moved a lot. I feel like I can assimilate to any environment. And it wasn't so overt. It was not like the documentary. This was a watered down version. You know, it wasn't the 70s. The free sex and love wasn't in your face the way it was back then. Mm-hmm. I think they kept it on the down low because there were a lot, they still wanted to make money. So there were a lot of Germans and Englishmen coming through. And that was always when it was funny was like we said, when you come from improv and comedy and even the yogi world, none of that stuff is really weird crawling around and pretending you're an animal. But for these very stuffy Brits and who were coming through, they would come in and have one night doing those exercises and be gone the next day.
I can relate to that though, because I think I've got like a lot of inner British inhibitions inside of me, and I find because mm-hmm. you do stand up, don't you, Bridget?
Uh huh.
Yeah. See, I find that stand up comedians, in my experience, we will appear to be making a fool of ourselves, but there's a part of me that really doesn't like you laughing at me unless I'm in control of why you're laughing at me. And I don't.
Right, it's control.
Yeah, and I don't like. It's hard. I've become a lot better about this the last few years, but it used to be very difficult for me to be vulnerable around people. I was able to. Mm-hmm. It's such a reflex to be like, ooh, I'm starting to feel uncomfortable. I'm going to crack a joke that's going to lighten the mood, and I'll put my mask back on, and so I can kind of, mm-hmm. I can see them coming in and being like, this is super weird, and me going like, wait, so I'm not just cracking jokes about stuff. I got to get on the floor and act like a lion. Ugh, I don't know. I'm not mm-hmm. sure how I feel about this. Okay, all right. So you're able to jump in.
I jumped in, and there was a lot about it that I liked in terms of just we worked in the bush, and it was there. The nature was amazing, and it was beautiful, and even the hard manual labor that we had to do every single day felt pretty good. And we ate it was all vegan meals. So you start after a few days. I mean, I had been partying in Sydney, so part of me was after about 4 or 5 days. I think I started. You know, you get really clear, but everybody has that weird glow in their eye. And then the longer you're in any environment, you start noticing the hierarchies and all of the drama. And I would always call it as the yurt turns, because it was like the.
I would watch
scary,
that. I'd watch that show.
Yeah, it was very, a lot of drama. Just humans like drama. We just like it, and we will create it anywhere, it seems.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. It's the drama tends to accompany human beings. It's not going to stop till the Vulcans or the robots take over.
The very first night, I straight up asked the guru, "Is this some kind of weird sex cult?"
Yeah. What did he say?
Because he said, "No, you do not have to have sex with anyone you don't want." I was like, "Well, that's not making me feel."
Well,
much
that just better. Tells me that the cult's not into rape, which is awesome.
Right,
you have the ability to turn down sex, like terrific. I got to say, every organization I've ever been a part of has had an equal standard of, hey, you know what? If somebody asks you to have sex, you don't have to have sex with them. Good to know. Thank you. This is an excellent Rotary chapter that I've joined.
I feel like that's not really taking. You still didn't answer the question of, is this a sex cult? Like, oh, so it's just a sex cult that doesn't rape you. Great.
Or like, I guess the other thing too is like, I've been, I was very religious when I was in high school and college, and I like for fun would go hang out at monasteries. And I can tell you that there was no sex going on, and if there was, somebody needed to get a talking to if they were having sex in the monastery.
Right.
So most of the spiritual destinations that I am familiar with have been fairly intense on abstinence and chastity. So is it, when we talk about a sex cult, is it just this is a spiritual location and also there is sometimes sex, or is sex an intrinsic part of the actual spirituality there?
With Osho, it was very much a part of his thing.
Okay, so it wasn't like, you know, pray a lot, but also sex is fine. Like, sex is a part of the teaching.
It's very, he had this whole theory of Zorba the Buddha. So
Zorba the Buddha?
Well, you know
Zorba the Greek?
The Greek.
Yeah, okay.
But then Buddha. So his whole thing was essentially irreverence and sexuality and this whole idea. He was a reaction to the intensely repressed ashrams that were very disciplined. And I've been on those ashrams too, where you have golden silence from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. Mm-hmm. You are observing, you know, an hour of chanting every single morning at 5 a.m. and
less random sex than normal. Yeah.
No sex at all. Complete celibacy. And everything is about refraining or abstaining from something.
Yeah.
And he reacted to that by saying, you know, no, life, you should be, you know, exploring the stories you're making up and meditating, but life isn't all just suffering. It should be kind of ecstatic and dynamic and expressive, and sexuality is a way to get in touch with a lot of this, and sex with many different partners. And that the Osho ashram, I remember because I had looked into the Osho ashram in India before I had started traveling, because I just didn't know where I was going to end up. And it struck me that you had to get an AIDS test before you even went to the ashram.
Yeah, I never had to get an AIDS test going to a monastery. That was never a part no one cared.
And I was not really that familiar with Osho, and I asked my yoga instructor who had been on that ashram and in India for a while, and he said, oh, it's because they encourage everybody having sex with each other, essentially. So it's just a kind of free. I don't know.
So I gotta say, I can't say I dislike this so far, because like if improv camp had just had like a, hey, you know what, like let's all kind of experiment and have sex with each other, as long as you're cool, it's cool. Like I kind of dig that so far. But I could see
it gets so complicated.
Yeah, see,
though.
that's where I get like I've got. Do you have polyamorous friends?
I've been.
You've been polyamorous.
I mean, I was the.
Of course, you have. You're a colorful person that goes into all these situations. Plus, you're probably attractive enough to pull it off. I think that's part of the. And by the way, I don't know what you look like, so I'm saying that because I'm just saying you seem like you date a lot. My friends that are polyamorous, when they're like when my polyamorous friends are like, it's great, you know, I date a bunch of people and like my girlfriend's into it and shit, and I'm like, right, because you're hot. You can do that. Like I look like, you know, kind of an Abraham Lincoln, Paul Rudd hybrid. I have to put in a little bit of elbow grease. If you're really attractive, you could do that and just find another attractive person and pair up and then date around. If you're part of the bottom 80%, it's the monogamy is kind of the default state. And I find that even then, a lot of my friends that have been polyamorous, it'll work really well for them for like 3 months. And then
it's just so hard. I don't know. I always ended up being in the unicorn role, as they call it, which is the, you know, for instance, I was kind of the, I would say in loose quotes, like second wife in an open marriage.
Oh, okay.
And that was an interesting just experience. And it was another kind of lifestyle. And then my sister and I joke, you know, where do you go from there? And it's like either you go even farther left or in my case, I think it just made me long for the stability that comes with monogamy. Mm. But polyamory is very, it works for people, but you have to have such open communication and clearly defined rules around, yeah. It's like improv. It seems like it's all just accidental, but
right.
You're creating a container for all of this stuff to happen. And
yeah.
I feel like polyamory, a lot of the time people don't have those conversations or things come up. And when you're just injecting, even in that environment, you're living together, you're working together, you're meditating together, you're sleeping together, it's bound to get messy and people are going to get hurt. And I mean, I saw so many people have mental breakdowns on that ashram. Just like, even I had a day where I felt like I was losing it. And it's so much focus inward too, because the whole point of an ashram is to basically only do spiritual work all day. Mm-hmm. You're putting yourself in an environment where every single thing is an expression of being in the moment, getting in touch with the God of your understanding or your meditation practice. Everything is a meditation. I mean, it's not easy to, you need a, an escape sometimes from your own mind, and people lose it.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that that would be a fairly intense thing. I also wonder, because I'm very much a I'm pretty open to other people forming experiences that I would view as weird. So if someone wanted to form a commune, which I guess would be the sort of non-pejorative version of a cult, if they wanted to do that and everybody had the ability to leave and like they're having a fun time, I'm all in favor of that. Where I would start to like get where I would get squirrely about it is, let's say you could technically leave, but it was kind of difficult to leave, either because of they were intentionally putting up logistical hurdles, or you know you could only leave once a week, or you had like intense hotboxing and pressure not to leave. And then some of the other things that I would be on the lookout for would be if there were caloric restriction, or if there were sleep deprivation, basically things designed to make you psychologically unstable. I would look at that and go, okay, that to me bespeaks more of a power dynamic than it does spiritual enlightenment.
And that was exactly, it is the way it starts to feel. You could leave any time, but you're in the bush. What are you going to walk out of this? So it was like, you know, if you wanted to go to the waterfall, you were on their schedule, and it did. There were days. The day that I lost it was a day where I felt like I was being held prisoner. Like we were supposed to go to the beach, and then the guru threw a little temper tantrum, and he decided that we weren't going to the beach because we all wanted it too much. And I lost it. I was so looking forward to jumping in the ocean, and it was, you could see the ocean from where we were off in the distance, and it was just so, I remember just crying hysterically and being so heartbroken. And it was just the pressure of being, it does start to wear you down. I can see how if you stay, all my friends who stay there, I've kept in touch with them. Their brains are all broken. I mean,
really?
Something happened there, but they were there for years. Month, you know, extended periods of time.
Oh, one of the other things I'll add is if they were intentionally trying to break down your self-esteem, that would be another thing that I would be on the lookout for.
Yeah, that was one of the things. The one girl who I'm still really good friends with, she was his right-hand man, and I used to hear him screaming at her. Mm. And the stories that I've heard since, because she got out and she's much more, I would say, it took her years to kind of reintegrate into society because those systems are so outside of society. It was completely self-sustainable. You have a compostable toilet. You use rainwater. It's cold showers. We had to build a fire every morning to cook our food. Everything took much. It was the way you lived before we had refrigerators.
Yeah.
And it was... It definitely.
You're talking about the radical pre-Netflix time of human history that you were going back to.
Yes, exactly. Before Wi-Fi existed. I mean, we didn't have phones. You were just cut off, and no television, no technology. And you essentially, you know, I was there for 3 weeks and started to really get squirrely and feel like I was losing it. And my friend who had been there for a while and who stayed, it was a whole family, brothers and sisters, and the girl seems better, but it's taken her a while. Her other sister never really got out of this. I think she's in another place. Mm. And the brother has just never been the same. His brain just, it got broken or something.
And he just can't function
in society.
Do you think that's intentional? Like, cause I, again, like if someone wanted to form a, you know, an Amish community or I'll probably go to a meditation retreat myself here in a couple of years. All of that sounds very good to me. And I like the idea of there being places that are on a different time frame and a different rhythm. Is it that this place were the problematic issues that it was just, separate and different, and that made it difficult for people to reintegrate into society? Was it just that there was a lot of drama, or was there something sinister there?
No, I think there was something sinister for sure. There was always that, you know, he would have had me stay there forever if
the guru
had been willing. Yeah. And I think you just, over time, the human mind is really fragile. It seems like if you do get broken down and you are disconnected and you're disconnected from your family and, you know, I think we underestimate the power of our being grounded in our storyline. And when you remove somebody from that lineage of their family and their community and put them in a totally alternate reality for a long enough time, it's easy to lose your way.
I could definitely see that. This is such a bizarre example to factor in, but my mind keeps gravitating towards this. One of my friends was a contestant on The Bachelor a few years ago.
I would imagine that would be insane.
She described it to me as basically, this is my interpretation of her describing these events to me. It sounded to me like Viet Cong torture tactics with cute cocktail dresses involved. They took her phone. They didn't want her to have any contact with her family or friends. And that's very intentional. They would constantly be pumping her and everybody else full of booze, and it wouldn't be like you get a glass of, you know, like, would you want a second glass? They would fill your glass up. You didn't have to drink it, but they would fill it up for you without telling you, so that you never knew how much you were drinking. They would give them a restricted caloric diet so that they're always kind of hungry, and then they'd literally sleep deprive them, based on what I heard. She'd go to sleep or she'd go to her hotel room, and then within a few minutes there'd be a knock and go, hey, you know, we're probably going to need you in a little bit. Can you come up? You know, had she at this point called her parents, they would have been like, sweetie, just leave. This doesn't matter. You don't know this guy. Don't worry about this. But when you're already in this kind of bizarre headspace, and there's these physical pressures, and now you're removed from any type of social safety net that would go, you're being freaking crazy. Like, take a deep breath. This is fine. Then you start to see that weird percolating happening and people freaking out on camera, which is the goal.
You see it in relationships. I mean, it's the definition of emotional abuse. And people, when people don't understand how people stay in these, you know, physically or emotionally abusive relationships, it's the frog in the boiling water. You just keep turning up the heat, and you don't really even know that you're in that situation until it's almost too late. And it's so crazy how quickly your brain adapts to essentially any kind of. That's how Stockholm syndrome happens. You know, it's a survival tactic to just kind of assimilate to whatever is happening around you, instead of it's sometimes easier in those situations, especially where you feel like you're being held captive, to just surrender.
What was your read on the guru? I mean, is this I'm also curious, in the same way that if you're completely removed from the society with which you're familiar, your social connections, your friends and family, you're probably going to egg out a little bit. I would think that if I were not only in that situation, but I were in charge of everything, I would like to think that I wouldn't go Colonel Kurtz. I'm aware that I might go Colonel Kurtz. There might be a disturbing element to me unleashed in that environment where I'm now Lord of the Flies, you know, head Boy Scout. Is the guru, do you think he was doing that? Just because I assume he was sleeping with followers. I don't imagine he had a prohibition subordinates and guru being inappropriate workplace relationships or anything like that.
Yeah, there was no HR that I could report to.
The commune HR was not chastising him. I mean, do you think that I think folks like that, I think, are very interesting in that you look back at, like, say, the more heinous popes in the Middle Ages, and I don't think that they were necessarily, you know, atheists that were gaming the system. I think that they believed some of it, but were also monsters. So in the case of this guy, I don't know. Do you think was he a spiritual person looking for spiritual fulfillment, looking to spread it, and also simultaneously a guy preying on, you know, members of the ashram for sex? Or was it a power dynamic? Or what do you think was going on?
I feel like that was what was so interesting about that documentary, is that you left it with those mixed feelings. Yeah. Like, some people really got a lot out of it and felt great. And I think they were insulated from a lot of the craziness and the drama. And it is very true in that I was very much, I would say in the drama of the, I would be like a series regular, you know, I was not a main, if the ashram was a show, and there definitely is a core group who they all orbit around whoever the guru is in these situations. and everyone's jockeying for favor, and there's a lot of power dynamics, and it ends up that's where the primary source of drama. And if you're like me, where I was slightly removed from it, although every week that I was there, I felt myself becoming, you become more and more of a core member, because there were so many people coming and going, but I could kind of stay removed and enjoy it. So I can see how you could interview somebody who was on that insane ashram in Oregon, and it was, they would be like, I had a great time.
That's how, except for the poisoning stuff and trying to kill a doctor and like a couple of, except for that stuff.
Like, they probably didn't know anything about
that.
Say,
if I was just one of the dudes that was building houses with my friends, like, I'd be like, yeah, it's great. Yeah. I was out in the sunshine. Everybody liked each other. Everybody was super friendly. You know, we were getting up with a purpose in our day.
Noises. Yeah. And so it's interesting because I think, what is it, like the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I don't know how, that's the weird thing about even this concept of evil and our potential for it. It's so insidious because power is so corrupting. Mm. And so even if you started something like that with, like you said, with great intentions, the power, you know, you saw that with him in the documentary, how he ends up being seduced by Hollywood and now he's got money and all of these fancy trappings of material wealth.
He had, what, 120 Rolls Royces by the end?
Yeah.
Which I would say I would probably three would be sufficient for my purposes. I think I'd tap out at three and be like, I could find something better to do with my enormous wealth. I'm going to get a Zeppelin.
I mean, he went from being this like humble guru from India to like a Saudi prince, you know, a lot of it is the discussion of ego. And when you're in those situations and you're trying to break down the ego, but the ego again will attach itself to anything. So it can attach itself to look how spiritual I am. It can attach itself to, it's just so insidious. And when you combine that with all of these sycophants and people who are kind of worshiping and hanging on your every word, he was wise. There were moments with him where I was like, wow, this guy's super creepy. And I get the weirdest vibe from him. And I feel like he's not a good person and a liar. And then there were other times where he could kind of be incredibly insightful and was able to offer me perspective or wisdom that I still to this day remember.
Okay. I could see that happening. I think power is corrupting for sure. There's also just if no one's actually criticizing you, like I think about like Kim Jong-un and his ridiculous haircut. No one in his entire life has ever gone, you know, you look like kind of a moron with your haircut. Like, maybe you should look a little bit less like a South Park character. If my life, everything I did, everyone went, that is the greatest thing that's ever, like, you would have no method of calibrating anything. And even were that to happen later in life, where you to become a guru in your 20s, 30s, whatever, I could see that kind of having an untethering effect.
Look at Kanye. I think essentially, like, if you take Kanye and put him on an ashram and he's in charge,
Watch the hell out of that documentary. I hope that happens now. I hope Kanye gets an island and, like, 400 interesting photogenic followers and just becomes cult leader of that island. I would 100% watch that.
Kanye as a cult leader would be amazing.
I would at least think about it. There was a I need to find this book. I've been meaning to read this, but there was a guy pre-Craigslist in England that started a cult, and he was very upfront that it was a cult, but he did it by, again, pre-Craigslist. He would just take out advertisements in newspapers, and it would say, "Join me." And it would give his phone number. That was the entire advertisement. There was nothing more than that. And then people would call him and he'd be like, yeah, I'm starting a cult. Here's the stuff that the cult believes. I don't believe any of it. And apparently, like, he got like a decent following and people just were like, yeah, I want to be a part of something. I'll come do it. And I like that because I feel like that guy's being very honest about his intentions and he's being very upfront about any of the nonsense. And
Is it any better? I have issues with that. Yeah. I feel like, that's like the guy who's like, what? I'm an asshole.
None of this matters. I told you I'm going to use mind control Jedi tricks to seduce you and then break down your self-esteem. I was upfront about that. How am I bad?
I don't know. I'm a huge believer in personal responsibility, but that whole idea of like just being open about the fact that you're doing something horrible and being okay with it.
Okay.
Is like
you've taught me.
Better.
You've taught me out of my mild Colonel Kurtz embryonic state. I will avoid doing that.
I do respect the hustle. You know, I just think people are so. People just want to belong. They want to belong to something. It's deeply human.
What? So before we sign off, I am fascinated by intentional living. There's something appealing about a commune to me. I've never been to a commune, but I've researched communes because I've thought about taking a vacation to go stay at one. I had a guest on my program a couple of weeks ago, Sebastian Younger, who wrote a book on kind of the idea that a lot of the psychological anguish that we're seeing writ large in society is because we've sort of alienated ourselves from being a part of very intense communities. And so I look at communes a little bit wistfully, going, "Oh, that kind of I could feel like I belonged someplace if I were part of it." Are you? I guess what is the difference between a cult and a commune in your mind, or are they the same thing?
No, they're not, because I've been unintentional. I've done that too.
Okay, all right.
up in Oregon, actually, but it was more like in the we'll call it the goat farming industry, but just think of like Northern California.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that kind of life up and very much living off the land. And, you have freedom to come and go and you have your own, I think with the cult that there's an intentional living, the ideology is intentional living. Mm. Whereas usually in a cult, you're intentionally living under some kind of other ideology.
Yeah, I'm intentionally forfeiting all of my willpower to Sauron. And I guess that does make a difference.
They're constantly trying to like get more money out of you in cults, I think. They were always, and it's more... I could kind of believe, and again, it's a thin line. I think that there are probably many intentional communities that have, I think that ashram started with the concept of being an intentional community. And then, you know, it only takes one guy who gets enough of a following and people worshiping. I'm very distrustful of somebody who has lots of sycophants and enjoys being put on a pedestal.
Yeah.
That's the difference between intentional community. Generally, there isn't one person who everybody is revering.
Okay.
And a cult always has kind of a main cult figure.
Okay.
It's like the person that, you know, the cult revolves around.
That is...
It's not really a cult without a leader.
Okay, that is good to know for my forthcoming vacation plans. If I'm looking at a, you know, intentional organic farming community or whatever, and in all caps, like, it follows the teachings of Robert. Robert is the greatest man who ever lived. I'll be like, I don't want to do that. I'm going to go to this goat farming one in Northern California, live in a yurt. And try that out.
Totally go with you.
Nice.
I love it.
Okay. Well, we've got we'll be in contact regarding our forthcoming goat farming vacation plans. Bridget, it's been really fun talking to you. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. You too. Have a happy Valentine's Day.
You too. Happy Valentine's Day. And now for something completely different. Cool 2019 dating apps that I think you should know about. We've been researching these all week. I think they're all very useful. And so I'm going to bring them to you as part of my tech benefits on this program. There's the iPhone Prophylactic app. This ramps up the amount of radiation on your smartphone in your pocket, which makes you sterile. There's the important person impersonator app. You select the time, and then someone will call you pretending to be a senator or a spy or a famous actor on your date, and that will make you seem more important. I tried that. Unfortunately, I picked some dead actor, and it was very awkward, and then I had to pretend it was a ghost. But you could make that work for you. There's Manifesto. This is an app that consists entirely of you writing a political manifesto and specific ideological demands. You do it in all caps. You don't even list your interests. You just shout your politics, and then it hooks you up with other people who can't disentangle politics from every single part of their life. So a good app for you guys. There's Puppy Adder. This app photoshops puppies into all of your photos, and it adds brand names to your clothes like Gucci to make you seem more wealthy. So that's going to help you with Instagram photos and online dating. There's Expectations Manager app. This is a pretty smart one. This makes all the people you encounter online look fatter and older in their pictures so that when you meet them in person, you're pleasantly surprised. And then finally, there's the Dark Knight app, which I use all the time. It's an app that connects to a bat signal on various buildings in your city. So when you press it, it will shine the bat symbol into the clouds, and you can look up at it and go, I gotta go, and then make a cool, discreet exit. Do a little bit of listener feedback before we close this up. A review from Missouri Douglas on iTunes. He says, dry humor and great sponsors. However, if you're a glow-in-the-dark cheese-making mime, you might become triggered. That is factually accurate, and thank you for the review. I appreciate it. And if you, listening at home, haven't reviewed us yet, please do so. Announcement. I'd like to bring to your attention Mercury One's upcoming leadership training program every summer in collaboration with Wall Builders. Mercury One opens its doors to emerging young leaders. Their leadership training program offers participants a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to gain hands-on experience with original historical documents. Participants not only gain a deeper understanding of American history, but also learn how to question boldly, think critically, and engage in meaningful discourse when confronted with differing opinions. All very good things, in my humble opinion. The unique program, designed for ages 18 to 25 and helmed by historians David and Tim Barton and special guest speakers, takes place in Dallas this summer. Mercury One is now taking applications. There are limited spots available, and this program will fill up at last. So if you're a younger person looking to develop leadership skills, maybe look into this. The first session is from June 3rd through the 14th, and the second session is July 15th through the 26th. To apply, please visit mercuryone.org. That's mercuryone.org/LTP. I bungled that originally. mercuryone.org/LTP. So mercuryone.org/LTP. Or call 972-499-4747. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/Mighty Heaton, or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at mightyheaton.com and just replying when I send it out on Fridays. I'd also like to encourage you to subscribe to Blaze TV and download the Blaze TV app. If you do, you can watch me instead of just listening to me. Use the promo code Heaton to get $10 off your annual Blaze TV subscription. I look like I could mind wrestle Spock. So download the Blaze TV app on iTunes or Google Play, get subscribed to the Blaze, and then fall in love with me more than you already are. You can also watch portions of the show on Facebook Watch by going to facebook.com/HeatonTV. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage. For KACL, I'm Dr. Fraser Crane. Thank you.